as have I. But we can do more as a state, and I would love to see us continue to push back against those efforts nationally that are threatening to take resources away, that are threatening to be punitive to those of us that have incorporated and put forth policies and laws that are supportive of all members of our city, including our undocumented immigrants.
Just to be clear, Trump is calling for taking away federal monies from cities that are sanctuary cities. Federal monies, of course, are tax dollars, but it wouldn't be taking away his tax dollars because he doesn't pay taxes.
Exactly. Larry, we still don't know about that. But yes, it's being really punitive. And we passed a resolution in the New York City Council saying that we are proud to consider ourselves a sanctuary city and that we will continue to support the initiatives and the laws that we've put in place and will push back against any effort to take anything away from us.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Melissa Mark Viverito is the Speaker of the New York City Council, the first Latina and the first person of color to be the Speaker of the New York City Council. Jose Lopez Rivera, thanks so much for being with us from Chicago, the brother of Oscar Lopez Rivera. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gabasdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, and Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Happy holidays.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 5 p.m. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Starting November 1st and wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the city of Portland has sold Terminal 1 to the Lithia Motors Corporation of Medford.
A Washington State Republican senator has introduced an economic terrorism law targeting civil disobedience.
And a Harvard University study has determined that North Carolina is no longer a democracy.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 23rd, 2016. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Lithia Motors of Medford, Oregon has agreed to buy Terminal 1 from the city of Portland for $12.5 million. The bid exceeded the next highest bid by $1.4 million and was twice what the city paid for the site in 2004. Lithia Motors is the seventh largest automobile dealer in the United States. Initial reports indicate the company plans to consolidate many of their Portland operations under one roof at Terminal 1. Earlier this year, developer Homer Williams had recommended that the site be used for a homeless campus, providing both shelter and support services to the homeless. The city initially supported Williams' proposal and was prepared to rent the facility at well below market rates. They were later forced to abandon that support in the face of opposition from neighbors and a lawsuit by Portland attorney John DiLorenzo. DiLorenzo claimed that by offering the facility at a reduced rate, sewer utility ratepayers would be subsidizing a project that has nothing to do with their bills.
The Multnomah County Sheriff, who broadcast the words "Vote Trump" from his cruiser at voters standing in line to cast their ballots on Election Day, has triggered an investigation by the Secretary of State. The Oregonian reported today that the sheriff's office has identified the officer who broadcast the pro-Trump slogans from the cruiser, but they're not releasing his name. A witness reportedly said that he was in line with roughly 25 or 30 people when, quote, a blue and white car that said sheriff, end quote, drove by. The witness said, quote, it was a cop. He said over the car speaker megaphone, vote Trump. End quote. Multnomah County election staff who witnessed the incident also filed reports with state election officials. The sheriff's spokesman said an internal investigation has also been opened.
The Endangered Species Coalition has created a list of endangered species that deserve to be prioritized and protected by the incoming Trump administration. The Oregon News Service and KBOO's Ray Bodwell have this report.
Conservationists have highlighted 10 endangered species that deserve attention from the coming administration, and three of them are in Oregon. In the Endangered Species Coalition report, which is entitled Removing the Walls of Recovery, one of the species identified is the gray wolf, which is making a slow recovery in the Northwest. The report points to humans as the animal's greatest threat. Leah Cheek, with the Endangered Species Coalition, says the species is largely misunderstood.
There's a lot of opposition and confusion about who wolves are as a species. They have a bad reputation. They think of them as killers, but in fact, they're really important for the environment.
Cheek says that as apex predators, wolves help maintain population levels of species they prey on. They provide an economic benefit to humans in the form of tourism as well. The list also includes the Snake River salmon and the greater sage grouse. Cheek says the salmon are an important source of food for orcas, but are threatened by four dams in the lower Snake River. Sage grouse are at the center of a massive conservation effort of the Sagebrush Sea in the west. Cheek hopes the report can spur the next administration to prioritize protecting these species.
Endangered species are really going to be facing a lot of challenges in the coming years because of climate change, because of increasing populations, and because of changes in the political landscape. So it will be really important for everybody to stay supportive and protective of the resources that we have in these species.
The other seven species named in the report are the bald cypress, the elkhorn coral, the Joshua tree, a yellow-faced bee from Hawaii, the jaguar, the African elephant, and the vaquita, a small Mexican porpoise. For Oregon News Service and KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Washington State Senator Doug Erickson has introduced a bill that creates the new crime of economic terrorism. Under the proposed law entitled the Preventing Economic Disruption Act, protesters who block streets, cause property damage, threaten jobs, or put public safety at risk could be charged with felony prosecution. The Ferndale Republican and Deputy Director of the Washington State Donald Trump campaign said that the new law would allow felony prosecution of those who attempt to intimidate or coerce private citizens or the government by obstructing economic activity. The ACLU of Washington expressed concerns that the broad nature of the proposal appears to be an attempt to equate civil disobedience with terrorism. ACLU spokesman Doug Honig noted that under the act, civil rights protesters who sat down at lunch counters could be seen as disrupting business and obstructing economic activity. Jackson Ravens, Washington State Democratic chair, issued a statement saying, quote, this menacing grandstanding by a Trump loyalist serves no purpose other than to chill dissent and discourage free speech, end quote.
Activism takes many forms, and creative people locally and internationally are finding ways to take action. At the Blazers game on Wednesday, a group called Brocial Justice was handing out flyers to stimulate conversations about gender and consent. The flyers had phrases such as, make sure the ball is always in your partner's court, and bros do the dishes. Women and non-binary folks get stuck doing most of the work around the house and don't get paid for that work. That's bogus. The Blazers have asked the group to stop handing out the flyers and to stop using the team logo on their material. The Blazers said they had no comment on the flyer. Across the world in Germany, a 70-year-old grandma isn't just scrubbing dishes. She's scrubbing out hateful graffiti from the German capital. Ermela Schramm spends up to 17 hours a week seeking out swastikas and, more recently, anti-refugee graffiti painted across the German capital and covers them up with big red hearts. She's been doing this for 30 years. Threats from neo-Nazi groups and the police have not swayed her. She has estimated that she's painted over more than 130,000 stickers, flyers, and signs. Schramm says, quote, "If you don't do it yourself, it just won't get done."
Carl Wilson is a Republican representative in the Oregon legislature. He serves District 3, which covers Grants Pass and Josephine County, far outside the reach of KABU's broadcast signal. But his influence on committees that focus on education rules and marijuana sales affect the entire state. KABU's Don Merrill spoke with Representative Wilson in the second of a two-part conversation about PERS, taxes, and the quality of Oregon education.
You're also on the House Interim Committee on Education. And so I have a couple of questions to ask you about that as well.
Sure, you bet.
Now, since the Oregon Supreme Court turned down the legislature's attempt to fix the funding issues as they relate to PERS, I understand that schools in the state are going to be absorbing the cost of Tier 1 payouts.
That is something that the Education Committee doesn't have anything to do with, but the options are fairly well hemmed in by the judiciary. As to how the mandate is going to be met, it's unknown. I think the legislature will try for some fixes. I don't know specifically what they are at this point. I understand there are probably four or five or six possibilities out there. But again, the courts have been very specific about what the legislature is allowed to do as it relates to PERS. And so at this point in time, everybody realizes we have a problem, but there is no one specific solution that is preeminent at this point.
So then the Education Committee is concerned with the quality of the education, not necessarily how the schools are financed.
That is correct. Your Ways and Means Committee will handle the finance side. Your Education Committee, as it currently stands, takes care of all the policy issues, such as graduation rates, absentee rates, things like that.
Well, that sort of relates to the question, I guess, because how can your committee, which focuses mostly on the quality of education, help improve Oregon's poor performance with regards to its standing compared to other schools and states in the country, as well as attendance problems, without knowing how much money they're going to have to do it?
Yeah. Well, we just simply don't. And I've got to cede that to you. We do not know what kind of money we're going to be dealing with. But on the other hand, an issue apart from money would be what are we going to do that keeps kids interested in coming to school? Why is our absentee rate so high? A lot of folks think that it is curriculum-based, and that is many kids don't come to school because they do not find the curriculum relevant, especially for those who are seeking to enter the job market. So we need to look, apart from any money issues, we've got to find out what we're teaching and why we're teaching it and make sure that we're offering compelling courses in career and technical education to keep high schoolers interested. Also, we need to figure out what's going on in many of the homes where these kids, frankly, do not leave each day. Many of them are taking care of their families, involved in child care or other issues. Their parents are not interested in getting them to school, and we've got to figure out why that is and what's going on in those homes.
You're also on the House Interim Committee on Rules. And as I understand, a rules committee, I mean, rather than being responsible for a specific area of policy, like most committees, the rules committee more or less determines which rules from other bills make it to the legislative floor. And so you guys are sort of like a traffic cop on how legislation moves through Congress or through the legislature. So I wanted to ask you. Your last meeting was in March. I want to know when your next one is going to be, and what do you think is going to be on your agenda? Do you know yet?
Well, that's one thing exciting, Don, about the Rules Committee, and that is that the Rules Committee is used basically as a tool or a repository of the majority party. So I know this for a fact because I used to be the chair of rules back when the Republicans were in the majority back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so that is one thing about rules. You do know that you'll probably deal with any election-related issue that comes through, as that is always an interest of the Rules Committee. However, the Rules Committee is a place where bills go to live or die at the behest of the House Speaker. And so it is a grinding experience in many cases for the minority members, because some of the more controversial end-of-session things will run through the Rules Committee. You know what the outcome is going to be before debate even starts, but you have to go through with it, and you take public testimony, and you go to a vote. And if you're the minority party, you will tend to lose, because the bills that really absolutely have to pass or have to die are typically sent to the Rules Committee, and especially toward the end of session.
That was KBOO's Don Merrill speaking with Republican Representative Carl Wilson. Mr. Wilson serves District 3, which includes Grants Pass and Josephine County.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Portland area weather tomorrow, partly cloudy with temperatures in the low 40s, and east of the Cascades, similar conditions but slightly cooler. On this date in 1788, Maryland agreed to cede an area not to exceed 10 square miles for the seat of the national government. That area became the District of Columbia. Today's quote is from humorist P.J. O'Rourke. He said, "The mystery of government is not how Washington works, but how to make it stop."
The latest in worker-related news from Doug Cunningham at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois is in its second year without a state budget. That has impacted education and social services, among many other things. Illinois Federation of Teachers President Dan Montgomery says Governor Bruce Rauner refuses to act in the best interests of the state because he's so obsessed with trying to destroy workers' unions.
We're in year two of Illinois with no budget. That's because he has held the state hostage and absolutely refused to produce a budget unless the legislature gives into his anti-union, anti-worker demands. He has said he's got this so-called turnaround agenda that includes dismantling workers' compensation, changing union rights to get rid of collective bargaining or severely restrict it, increasing outsourcing and privatization. And the Democrats, to their credit, have held firm and said, look, those are not budget-related items, and we're not going to do these really hurtful and extreme things that are out of the norm of Illinois politics just so you can get a budget.
Montgomery says the IFT and other public sector unions are going to keep fighting for the best interests of Illinois working families.
We're going to continue to fight for working people. What the governor needs to do in running the state, he's got an allegiance to the state, not to his party, not to an ideology. He is totally out of sync with the state of Illinois, and we need a new governor in 2018.
Thanks to laborers, Local 165, seven non-union workers in Peoria, Illinois, will get thousands of dollars in wages owed them from work they did for NMR renovations. Local 165's Matt Bartolo.
Our morals and principles doesn't allow us to turn our back on these workers, whether they were our members or not. We're in the business of representing workers, and no worker needs to receive that kind of treatment.
The workers were misclassified as contractors and, in effect, had their wages stolen. Clint Drury is executive director of the West Central Illinois Building and Construction Trades Council.
We'll defend all workers from the unfortunate injustices they face every day, and this is going on throughout the country. It's not just Peoria, Illinois. And the residents of Peoria and nationwide are fed up, and it has to end. So thankfully, in this case, justice workers, and it's just in time for Christmas.
Midwest Region Foundation for Fair Contracting's Dane Simpson.
Some of these workers were making less than $3 an hour. They were not getting paid their overtime. They were not getting paid for their weekend work. And to be honest, they weren't getting paid in the hours that they were reporting to their supervisor, Nathan Moore.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A study released yesterday by the Electoral Integrity Project, based at Harvard University, found that North Carolina is no longer a democracy. The Harvard researchers listed access to polling places, fair representation, and equal treatment under the law as standards for judging what is considered a democracy. North Carolina received just 7 points out of 100 for integrity of its voting district boundaries. The Electoral Integrity Project says North Carolina is the, quote, worst entity in the world it has ever analyzed, unquote. Andrew Reynolds, author of the report, said, North Carolina's overall electoral integrity score of 58 out of 100 for the 2016 election places us alongside authoritarian states and pseudo-democracies like Cuba, Indonesia, and Sierra Leone.
Senator Jefferson Sessions, the man Trump has chosen for attorney general, was accused by an Alabama judge in 1997 of the worst misconduct ever witnessed by that court. Sessions was Alabama state attorney general at the time. The case stemmed from his prosecution of Tieco Inc., a Birmingham, Alabama turf and industrial equipment company. Sessions' office accused Tieco of cheating customers and suppliers through bogus billing and kickbacks. The defense for Tieco and the case stated that they had never seen a case like this before where the government had used its police powers to assist a civil case. The lawyers stated, quote, there should be a bright line between how civil and criminal cases are handled, end quote. The judge in the 1997 civil case described Sessions' actions as, quote, either intentional and deliberate misconduct or conduct so reckless and improper as to constitute conscious disregard for the lawful duties of the attorney general and the integrity and dignity of this court and this judge. End quote. It appears that Sessions is going to have a tough time being confirmed as Attorney General. In 1986, he was denied a federal judgeship by the state Republican majority due to charges that he had a history of making racially insensitive statements and held racist views.
Canadian fossil fuel projects, including recently approved expansions of pipelines in Alberta and British Columbia, are meeting fierce opposition from local Indigenous communities. Currently, two such communities are challenging the Canadian federal government before the Supreme Court. They argue the government failed to seek their informed consent for development projects, which they say threaten the values of their culture and the well-being of the environment. Patrick Barrios reports from Ottawa.
In a lawsuit currently before the Supreme Court of Canada, the Chippewa of the Tams and the Clyde River Inuit say the Canadian government did not fulfill its constitutional duty to consult Aboriginal communities before approving fossil fuel projects in their territories. Both sides made their arguments before the High Court in a joint hearing late last month. Nader Hassan, the Clyde River Inuit's legal counsel, says the court's decision will establish a legal precedent defining what it means to properly consult Aboriginal communities.
This case, at its core, is about the soul of Canada and what kind of a nation we want to be. Do we want to be a nation that takes our obligations to First Nations and Indigenous peoples seriously? Or do we want to be a nation that allows governmental bodies and industry proponents to reduce Aboriginal rights to basically a checklist item?
The Clyde River Inuit are opposing a seismic exploration project near Baffin Bay. This project looks for oil deposits to sell to companies interested in offshore drilling. As described in a National Energy Board report, a seismic ship would travel back and forth for 5 years, towing up to 34 air guns. Every 15 seconds, these air guns would produce underwater sound blasts of 230 decibels. That's louder than a space shuttle launch, and more than loud enough to instantly kill a human. Hassan says the Clyde River Inuit are concerned that seismic exploration will harm marine wildlife integral to their culture and diets.
In Clyde River, you can't just go into your local supermarket and buy all of your nutritious food. That food is prohibitively expensive. It's all airlifted from the south, and you'll be paying 5-10 times more than you would in an Ottawa or Toronto supermarket. So people up there depend on traditional food sources for their nutritious food. The ringed seal, the harp seal, the bearded seal, the narwhal, the bowhead whale, all these traditional food sources.
The National Energy Board's report seems to validate the Clyde River residents' concerns. It states that over 180 species of fish have been identified within the project area, as have marine mammals such as the endangered bowhead whale. Despite this, the board approved the projects, citing dozens of proposed mitigation measures. Another issue before the court deals with a controversial pipeline project. The Chippewa of the Tams are opposing the reversal and expansion of Enbridge's Line 9 pipeline. The energy delivery company's website states that the pipeline's expansion allows for transportation of heavy oil. The National Energy Board approved this project in 2014, and it is already in operation. The board claims potential damage to indigenous land is likely minimal, and that it would be appropriately mitigated. But Chippewa ceremonial drummer Todd Riley says environmental damage is inevitable if oil continues to flow.
It's not if it spills, it's when. Everything man-made is going to fail. How are we going to fix that? It's going to take generations. We got to get all our First Nations together and stop this. This decision here is big.
Canadian Indigenous communities say fossil fuel projects threaten a lifestyle they've held onto for thousands of years and contradict a value system that prioritizes environmental integrity over profit margins. Hundreds rallied outside the Supreme Court in support of the Chippewa of the Tams and the Clyde River Inuit during the joint hearing in November.
Water is sacred!
Water is sacred!
Water is life!
Water is life!
Cree Chief Mistawasis explains that the natural world is integral to First Nation identities.
The trees, the birds, the animals, the fish, the environment is a library. As Indigenous people, it's our duty to consult with the water. It's our duty to consult with the air. That is our library. We're the librarians.
Perry Bellegarde, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, took a moment to survey the crowd before his address. Among the gathered, shivering in the cold, were elders and youth, Indigenous and non-Indigenous alike. Bellegarde says such unity is essential if Indigenous rights and voices are ever to be respected.
We don't see any color. We don't see black people, yellow people, white people, red people. We are the two-legged tribe. And if this worldview that I just described can be taken up by governments and industry, it'll be a powerful world for all of us.
The Crown claims that, through the National Energy Board, it has fulfilled its constitutional responsibility to consult Aboriginal communities. The justices are reviewing the case and are expected to issue a ruling in the coming month. Patrick Barrios, FSRN, Ottawa.
The U.S. Justice Department has subpoenaed a whistleblowing former Wells Fargo employee in its ongoing criminal investigation into the bank's opening of over 2 million bogus accounts. The DOJ has asked Yesenia Guitron to testify before a San Francisco grand jury that is considering criminal charges. Guitron is among at least five Wells Fargo employees who sued the bank or filed complaints with regulators alleging that they were fired after reporting the opening of customer accounts without the customer's permission. The Justice Department subpoena directs Guitron to bring all documents related to her employment, including any related to sales practices, discipline, or, quote, other forms of retaliation against you by Wells Fargo or by Wells Fargo employees, end quote. In 2010, Guitron and other personal bankers filed a federal lawsuit claiming that the bank had retaliated against them. She claims that bank managers retaliated by falsifying a paper trail documenting poor performance. A federal judge ultimately dismissed all of Guitron's claims, saying that Wells Fargo was justified in firing her because she had failed to meet sales quotas.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Letigre, Lisa Loving, Stacy Holtman, and Khalid Mosley. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio. Guest host Linda Olson Osterlund welcomes the founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund to discuss the Trump regime's efforts to keep protesters away during Inauguration Day. At 9, social and political commentary from the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes Ben Schreiber from the Friends of the Earth. They'll talk about Trump's rogues gallery of cabinet picks and the damage they may do to the very agencies they're being tasked to lead. At 11, the Arctic report card, how the melting Arctic might affect the rest of the world. At 11:30, Voices for the Animals, giving you three compelling reasons to go vegan in the new year. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can be